The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 488, recorded on January 1st, 2018. Welcome to 488th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and a 321st episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Powell.
I am TJ Denzer.
And I am Scott Dirk.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry. So yeah, I'm excited that we actually have a podcast that's on January 1st.
Yay!
About that, I get to take over on the podcast description at 2018 now.
Whole new year.
Yep.
A whole new year. Anyways, there's not much news, obviously, except for the fact that, you know, we just had the holiday season and wondering what goodies people have had. So, Scott, what have you been playing?
I've been playing the heck out of South Park Fractured But Whole. I got it for Christmas, and I played it almost nonstop, just having a lot of fun with it. It's a nice continuation from the previous game, Stick of Truth. The boys decide, just, you know, on a drop of a hat, we're playing superheroes now, you know, no more of the fantasy stuff. And they just, you know, switch gears, and they have a whole new quest on what they wanted to do. They wanted to, like, you know, do this whole franchise thing. And you, of course, still have your farting mechanics as the new kid, and you get to customize your character as you're going along. All these different superpowers and what your character is. It's very interesting.
Is Kenny still cross-dressing?
No. He's playing Mysterion.
Oh, too bad.
why is he dressed as a princess? It's just a thing he's going through.
it's superheroes, so he's playing the character Mysterion, which was established on the show. So they're just, you know, everybody's playing the character that's already been established on the show, pretty much.
That's too bad. I would have preferred him to be in a Wonder Woman outfit.
He wasn't on the show, so that's, you know, he wanted to be Mysterion. He was the princess with the fantasy stuff, and now he's Mysterion, because they've established the whole backstory of him wanting to better his life, because he comes from a poor family.
Yeah, you know, the one thing is about the Fractured Butthole is that a lot of it is based on one episode. And if you hadn't seen that episode, it's like, wait, what?
There were multiple episodes.
I know,
about
but
it.
there's one aspect that it's strongly tied to one of the episodes.
Yeah. Oh, where they were talking about the franchise. Yeah, I think that's the one you mean.
Well, not only that, there's another one. You know, like I said, there's a lot of references to the actual shows that if you're not watching the show, you're going to get lost.
There are a lot of references they'll make. There was one that's really good. The Mephisto shows up because you haven't seen him in a long time, and he talks about having this little. He explains what that thing was that was standing next to him. It was his son, apparently, and then he talks about how his son died when some kids were messing with an artifact that belonged to Barbara Streisand, and suddenly Kenny's like, "Oh shit, I think that was us." So I thought that was funny, and that was a good nod, too. And again, there's a lot of good references there to previous episodes and different things they had done. There was a lot of good puzzles, a lot of collecting. Because in the first one, you were collecting some Pokemon little dolls, and then this one, you're collecting Yaoi of Tweak and Craig. So that's one of the things you're going after instead of little stuffed animals. But, I mean, it's a lot of the turn-based game action part is good. It's tactical. You have to pick your powers and figure out how to defeat some of the enemies. And there's some tough bosses in this game. So they definitely stepped up their strategy game with the boss.
I heard the Fractured Butthole is really easy. At some point, you just start curb stomping everybody.
No, there are some really tough bosses. I had a lot of trouble with the strip club when you're running down the hallway and there's this really fat stripper that's like stomping the ground coming after you. She got me the first time I faced off with him because I kept getting stuck behind people and getting pushed back. And then there was the big mutant, the deformed mutant that you had to fight, near the end of the game, which was very tough because you had to keep controlling the day and you had to wait for your turn to be able to do that. And so it wasn't as easy. Like the little guys, the little, you know, the little, like, you fight the Raisinettes and the sixth graders and some ninjas, and they're easy to take out, but the bosses, I thought, were still challenging and tough.
DJ, have you been playing the Fractured Butthole?
I have not started that one yet.
Okay, because I remember that you were actually very interested in it when we were at E3.
I think it's amusing, but I also think that it's difficult for a South Park game to be as cool as the Star Wars. I don't know. There's a very different dynamic for the game in comparison to the show because, I mean, they make a lot of their jokes based off of timely things. And,
yeah, I mean, the entire thing of one franchise, movie, cinematic franchise sucks, the other one doesn't, that's kind of old news. And that was basically the thing with The Stick of Truth. Yahtzee Croshaw pointed it out that the idea of pointing out that someone who never talks is kind of creepy was a joke that was being told in 1998 with Half-Life 2. You know?
That's, so, the silent protagonist has been around since Link.
I know, but lampshading the fact that anybody who was really like a silent protagonist would come off as creepy, that was a joke that was back in 1998.
I don't think they make the new kid creepy. They didn't make him creepy.
The fact he never talks makes him creepy. That's just, you know, they're just talking, you know, they just say, you know, someone who never talks is kind of creepy.
Well, I mean, if it's something that...
I don't know what to say.
And also, someone who never talks and his main attack is farting, that's even creepier.
I mean, if they address it in-game that he never talks, then that's something else. It's even creepier.
They did address it in-game in Half-Life 2. Alex went on about it.
But that's what I'm saying, is that I think if they address it, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of thing. That's something that Owlboy did. Here we go. It's 2018, my first chance to talk about Owlboy.
That's a 2016 game, isn't it?
Owlboy was mute. He couldn't talk even if he wanted to.
No, but that's what I'm saying, is that they really turned it into something really interesting with the mm-hmm. silent protagonist.
They definitely did.
They actually made it a disability of his character, and it's something that everybody else knew about and worked around.
By the way, I should mention that Owlboy's coming to Switch, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4 on February 13th.
Yes, I can't wait for it to call it my Game of the Year of 2018.
Well, the thing is that it'll give me a chance to play it, because I didn't get a chance to play it on PC. And if I play it, I might as well get achievements for it.
Yeah.
I think you can still get achievements for it on PC.
Yeah, I don't give a shit about Steam achievements. Okay. Achievements. They suck.
Not like Xbox achievements are somehow better.
Because I've been collecting Xbox achievements since 2005.
Okay. But, I mean, the point of the silent protagonist is to fill yourself in that thing.
Yeah, I know. And that's why you can customize them to look any way you like.
I don't mind it, you know, but it's like, I guess some people are tired of it, but I'm not, that they're, I'm not
no,
really,
no one's tired
really
of the silent protagonist. It's just that lampshading it is a, you know, is not a new joke. You know, the problem with Stick of Truth and the Fractured Butthole is that the humor itself is kind of dated.
I don't care.
I know. I'm saying you don't have to care. I'm just saying it is sort of dated. It doesn't make it bad. It's just sort of dated.
And that was my point too, is that there are some jokes that are pretty good in there from what I've seen a few of them, and they're pretty funny. That said, like, it's the difference between, I think it has to be like sort of a stark change for Matt Stone and Trey Parker, because you're talking about the difference between being able to crank an episode out in a week that's timely and has all the jokes of the time right there in front of you, and a thing that took what, three years?
Yeah, the only problem also is that, well, some of the jokes that they tell in those games are more than 3 years old. the problem with the show is that what's timely now is going to be incredibly dated later. I mean, I dare to watch a season 3 episode and not say, oh, I remember that.
But that wouldn't bother me. I wouldn't mind going back and watching an old episode. That's like saying, I don't want to watch a comedy from the 1800s because I wouldn't get it or whatever. It just, that doesn't register with me. It's like, it's just because something's old doesn't mean it's not worth watching. I just don't. Cause I played the game to see the characters, how they interact with this and how they deal with this problem. Because, you know, really, this is a continuing issue of Cartman. And I don't really
say it wasn't funny. We're just saying that the humor is dated.
That's fine. I don't care.
That's and no one's saying that, what's it called? It's a bad game either. I haven't played it yet, so I really can't address that. So, I will at some point. As a matter of, well, that'll be when I talk about what I've been playing. But what have you been playing, TJ?
I got the Mega Man Legacy Collection 2. So, I had not played through Mega Man 9 or 10. So one of my last things that I did before the new year was out was, play Mega Man 9 from beginning to end.
So you're talking about the, new old games.
Yeah.
Mega Man 9 and 10 are the retro games that try their darnest to seem like they were made in 1982. When they were made in, like, what was it, 2010, I think?
Yes. That's when they started creating those ones. But by NT Creates, nonetheless, the guys that do Azure Striker Gunvolt, which is another one of my favorite platformers on 3DS. By the way? I got it on PS4.
Okay. But it's also on Steam, and it's on Xbox One.
It's on everything, just about, besides Switch, I think. Yeah. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed going back to that style of game. They took out the slide and the charge feature in Mega Man 9, so it was kind of interesting to just have the Mega Buster and jumps, and that's it.
Yeah, I've never been a Mega Man game, because I don't want to play the Dark Souls of platformer.
I've also been playing that game as well.
I mean, here's the thing, you know, there are people who can play the entire game and get an achievement for just finishing the game only having fired once. I think there's an achievement for that, where you have to play the entire game, but you cannot fire more than once. And I think that's to kill one boss that you cannot kill any other way. And that's just too much for me. And
it was White Knuckle. It was when I got to, like, I had the first four levels of the game were fine, and I got through them okay, and I was like, this is a fun romp through my memories. I'm enjoying this. And then I got to the end of the game, and it turned from, this is a fun romp, into, holy shit, this is too much. Because I didn't do any research going into it. I just tried to use the best of my abilities to just figure it out, which was what I did when I was little. And I actually beat it, but there was a lot of yelling at the end, because Wily is... Oh my god, he's ridiculous.
At least with Mega Man 11, they're gonna ditch the 8-bit retro look and go to something that's a little more Mighty Number 9-ish. Or better than that, I mean, but you know what I meant. Something that's more up to date.
Other than that, I actually busted out a new board game this last weekend for New Year's.
Did you get Dark Souls board game yet?
No, but I got something really else that's really cool. It's, Infection at Outpost 31, the Thing board game.
Oh, okay.
Which,
actually, it's... I played the Dark Souls board game. It's pretty good. Very brutal.
The Thing board game is pretty damn awesome, too. It's based on the 1982 movie from John Carpenter.
Outpost at 31, by the way.
Did I say...
You said 13. You had dyslexia there for a second.
Oh, yeah. Outpost 31 is what I meant.
I guess they didn't want to be too obvious by calling it in the movie 13 or else. Oh, okay. We get it. Symbolism. It's a co-op game.
But, it is an co-op interesting. Trilogy? Yeah. It's essentially like murdery Clue. It's 4 to 8 players, and one of them is definitely the Thing. And, you have to go through the facility finishing missions in each room and finding equipment.
Have you ever played Chaos on the Haunted Hill?
I have not.
That's basically what this game is, with a different skin. Because House on the Haunted Hill is where you go into a murder house or a spook house, and at some point you keep on rolling omen dice, and at some point, oh, now we know who the traitor is, and they have to go off with their own rules, and then people have to go off this one. I know they don't have that omen roll. This is the one in which you have someone who's the thing from the start, right?
Yes, and there's a lot of rules to the game that allow people to be more deceptive, allow people to be more careful about what they are or who they are. One of the things about it is that you get each person plays a character from the movie. There are like three major classes of characters: operations, maintenance, and technical or whatever. And then there's like a character card for each of the characters from the movie, and they all have a special ability that can be used on cards or dice rolls in the game.
What did MacReady do?
MacReady can draw. I think Wiz was he can. You get supply cards in the game, and those are what you turn in for any given mission. So you'll get like an axe, and it has a +1 dice. So somebody will be able to. It'll add several more dice to somebody's hand if they have to do like a dice roll.
This game is so new. There's no reviews yet on BoardGameGeek.
Yeah, it literally just shipped in the middle of December.
And you know, I'm always for. You ever play Battlestar Galactica, the game?
I have not.
Oh God. That game is, here's the thing about Battlestar Galactica, the game. It's really complicated in terms of learning the rules and what the cards do. But once you're familiar with the game, it becomes white knuckle. Because here's the thing. It's one of those games in which there are two phases. You have the start phase and you have the mid phase. And what happens is at the beginning, people will figure out, they'll have two loyalty cards and they'll look at it and one of them and they'll see, oh, okay, I'm either a human or I'm a Cylon. But then at the middle of the game, you get dealt another card in the sleeper phase. And oh, by the way, you thought you were a human? Nope. You were a Cylon all along. And then you have to change your strategy because now you have to work on the Cylon side. And less than half, the number of people are going to be Cylons. So like if there's five players, three people are human, two people are Cylons.
There's an aspect like that in the thing as well. Like at the very beginning of the game, everybody gets a blood sample card, and the card either says human or infected.
Oh, so they're taking the Battlestar Galactica route. Okay.
And then the game board is like three major sections. You have to do certain objectives in each section to move to the next section.
Yeah, that sounds like Battlestar Galactica, because in Battlestar Galactica, you have two ships and you have to spend a card to move between ships. The expansions add more ships. Yeah.
And then on this one, basically the way you do it is there's investigations and you have to pass the investigation to reveal what is in that room, and it can either be a thing and you have to kill it, which achieves an objective. Or there could be a item like rope or dynamite or a flamethrower that helps you move along to the next section.
Yeah, the best part of Battlestar Galactica is every player has to do a crisis card. And it's like numbers. It'll be like 13, blue, green, and yellow. So what happens is all cards that are blue, green, or yellow are positive and anything else is negative. And you submit your cards face down and then you put in two cards from the Destiny deck to mix it up a little, and then you shuffle them so you don't know whose cards came from where. Mm-hmm. And if it fails, like, oh, okay. Who's the people who put those cards in there?
See, and that's sounding very similar, because everybody hands, at the beginning of an investigation, everybody hands in one card face down to help with the investigation or hinder it if you're the thing.
And I put in a random card.
And there's a card that's, there's cards that are sabotage cards. And if that one is pulled, it has to be played immediately, and then if it's not resolved, the investigation fails. And if investigations fail seven times, the contagion spreads and the thing wins.
So here's the thing is that, Battlestar Galactica was a very tense game because it was a lot of false accusations and suspicion, which I guess plays right into – and by the way, this is based on Jared Carpenter's thing. It's not the thing from another world. So, yeah, it's all about being suspicious of the other players, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm human, and I know at least one other one of you is human, because if you were all the thing, I would be dead now, so.
The other interesting aspect is that, like, what you said about the Cylon thing, when you unlock sections, it goes to an assimilation phase, and everyone draws a new blood sample card.
Yeah.
And so you could have a situation where someone that was human can now turn into the thing, is now the thing, and they've switched sides and they can't reveal it.
So basically they took Battlestar Galactica and made it a little simpler, because Battlestar Galactica is really, really extremely fun when you figure out the rules, but then you have to figure out the rules. once you figure out what the cards can do, then it's just basically numbers and colors, right? So yeah, I might pick this up, because it's hard enough finding people to play Battlestar Galactica. I have all the expansions from the base to Daybreak. Mm-hmm. I end up with Ellen Tig though. I'm always Ellen Tig, and everybody's suspicious of me because she's the one who's part of her role. She has to draw a treachery card. And anytime a treachery card pops up and then, and they all look at me and like, no, I didn't use a treachery card. I swear I didn't play it. And her main ability is that she gets to sleep around with everybody, the trade cards. She has to hunt people with the trade cards. And the funny thing is, I never really watched Battlestar Galactica, but I know from the game that she humps everybody.
Well, we had a good time with the thing. It's a 4-8 player game, and the more people that you get, the more intriguing it gets. The more things there are, the more possibilities there are.
You know, one of the best things about the thing soundtrack is it's very understated and it loops, so that's something you can play in the background while you play. Doom, doom, doom. Doom, doom. Anyways, I joined Gamefly again, partly because I would get a 490 gems from Cooking Dash if I do that, but also because I have to be economical and now I have to rent games. So the first game I've rented is Assassin's Creed Origins, because I know it's not something I'd want to buy, and it's probably going to arrive tomorrow. But I did buy myself something with the Xbox Live sale, and I bought the BioShock collection for $20.
Nice.
I'm surprised it's not Xbox Live, Xbox One X enhanced, but that's okay. I'm in the middle of BioShock, and I remember everything about it, and my gameplay is going really slow because I'm taking my time, and also I want to make sure that I get all of the audio logs, because I want to get that achievement. You know, I did it on the 360, and it glitched out and didn't give me the damn achievement. So I'm hoping they fix that bug, and I'm getting all. I'm not using a guide. I'm just going really slowly and covering every inch. I'm not going to use spoilers because the game was released in 2007. It's a 10-year-old game. I've gotten to the part in which the Bathy Sphere, which contains Atlas's quote unquote wife and child, explodes. So that's how far I am into the game. And as everybody knows, there is no wife and child because Atlas is really Frank Fontaine. There, I spoiled it for the one or two people who actually have not played BioShock. But you know, when I'm playing again, it's sort of like obvious that Atlas is fake, because when you get all these recordings about how big and bad Fontaine is, it makes Fontaine is Atlas, because they're not going to introduce that character and play him up so much that he's not going to be a factor in the game.
Yeah, I can see that. I haven't played through it in a while. Do you hear much about Frank Fontaine before you find out who he is?
I mean, here's the thing. You only hear about Atlas once, and you see a sign for Atlas. But a lot of it revolves around the fact that, Ryan humped this woman, Diane McClintock, and they're your mother and father, you find out. Spoiler. And then when you get a little bit deeper into the game, you talk about how this guy Fontaine has been muscling in on Andrew Ryan's territory and getting in a smuggling operation. You have these ghosts, and the famous one says, "Fuck Fontaine." The ghost says, you don't fuck Fontaine. Fontaine fucks you. You know, and all this is, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of obvious when you're playing it in hindsight how much they talk about Fontaine. So, now here's the interesting part. It's been graphically upgraded, but I'm telling you one thing. It doesn't look much different than my Xbox 360 version, which tells you how good the original version looked. I know it had revolutionary water physics at the time, and it's still pretty good.
Yeah, the switches between, like, ice and water are fantastic in that game. And not only that, but, like, being out in the ocean, or just, like, even that first moment when you run down through the bathysphere and then the curtain is drawn and you get to see the city underwater and you see the whale swimming underneath you, and it's amazing.
And of course, I am saving all the little sisters, as usual. I don't like to harvest them. Actually, I don't think I've ever harvested a little sister ever playing the game. There's no point to it, because that's one of the failings of the first Bioshock, is that there's no penalty for deciding to save them, because you get a big cachet if you save for every three that you save. There should be more of a moral choice, in which you get dick for saving them, but you get something for harvesting them. You know, so that it's a bigger choice. It's like, yeah, you really need that atom, you know, and if you harvest them, you're never going to see that atom. But if you save them, you're the only way you're going to see a lot of atoms is if you harvest them, you know. But if you save each one, yeah, you get a little bit, but then you get this huge bonus and gift and a lot of other things. It just, you know, they should have made it more of a moral choice. Your survival versus saving these little girls.
I think it'd be a better moral choice if there were no rewards either way. You just either do it or you don't.
Well, no, that's... I mean, if you're harvesting them, you're just being a dick. There's no reason to harvest them then.
That's
you have to, there has
my
to be...
point. I mean...
Here's the thing. If you go with Star Wars, you know, like Yoda says, the dark side is quicker. And that's basically that's basically what harvesting them is. It's the dark side. You're getting your atom quickly. You know? You know... If there was a real detriment to rescuing them, except for the fact that you saved them and you know that you saved them and you're going to get the good ending. And I will say this, you know, a lot of people bitched about the dual endings of Bioshock, you know, the good batting, the end batting. I did not understand why people bitched. I love the good ending. I love the good ending in which they talk about how you saved the sisters and they grew up and they, you know, they lived normal lives. And your reward was having a family that you never really had. I like the bad ending too, in which you just, you come up from Rapture armed with a nuclear bomb. And speaking of which, I've also played Bioshock 2 and Bioshock Infinite. Those are next. I really loved Bioshock 2, and I don't understand people's complaints about it. I will understand complaints about Bioshock Infinite because after playing it, I realized the story was stupid. The characterization was stupid. You know, let me put it this way. What is the major, first major beat that you have in Bioshock when you meet a splicer? You remember it. This woman is over a baby carriage and she's moaning about the baby she's lost and how she wants to caress and hug it. You know, and when you take care of her, you look inside the baby carriage, it's a gun.
Yeah.
And whenever the splicers can't see you, just listening to them to talk, you know, what's happened to me? And, you know, all these obsessions. Everybody loves the grand damn splicer too, you know. When she attacks you, she says, they would throw you out of a restaurant for serving a steak that bad. You know, that sort of stuff. In Bioshock Infinite, they're just there for target practice. They have no characterization whatsoever. They're racist assholes and that's it. There's no difference between the factions. There's nothing. And the end battle is basically, what's it called? Arena battle, in which you're just waiting for the bird to show up, and that's it. There's nothing to it. I mean, yeah, fighting Fontaine at the end was stupid, but I loved the nuanced endings of Bioshock 2, you know? Especially if you do the really good ending. Your daughter learns compassion and she saves Sophia Lamb from dying and, you know, and all that stuff. And, you know, she injects you into her body and she knows that you're going to be a good spirit for her to have, that sort of stuff. And the multiplayer was also really good, and that's one of the underappreciated facts of Bioshock 2.
Yeah, it's, you do get, like, environmental storytelling from the characters in Bioshock.
And Bioshock 2.
And, like, I love coming up in the hallway, you hear that guy singing, Jesus loves me, this I know.
Because the Bible tells me so.
But,
that's when you first take photos
Bioshock
of him.
2. Bioshock 2 is like the multiplayer in there is like the multiplayer is just a really nice expansion into the actual downfall of Rapture as people are just like going
nuts. New Year's Eve 1959, have fun.
People are going nuts. Each of them had their own dreams and goals. They've all become ridiculously spliced and horrible and are getting worse and worse as things go. And the idea is that you're just watching this war unfold in real time. Like, the curtains are pulled back. The hostilities are out there.
You know, I haven't gotten to Sander Cohen yet. And that everybody says that's the highlight of Bioshock.
It's one of them.
By the way, there's something that people have started to notice that they didn't notice before after playing it a lot. Everything happens in that scene in tune to the music. Everything. Now, you could actually help out, and I've read where people said they started firing their shotguns in time of the music as well. Which is hilarious.
That's a neat little extra.
Yeah. But Bioshock Infinite, you know, it's half finished, and there's no characterizations, you know. I wish it was more rewarding, and the ending also really makes no sense. I mean, people said, oh, well, it's a commentary on what's it called, and playing video games and all that. Yeah. But if you think about the story in text, it's like, oh, wait, it really doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, Bioshock Infinite also has the best combat. And by the way, it's a spiritual, the first Bioshock was a spiritual successor to System Shock, right? But one thing about System Shock 2 is the combat sucked. And the one thing that Bioshock brought to it, it streamlined everything. I mean, now you don't save potato chips. Any food that you find goes straight in your mouth. But the combat, when I first played it, was, oh, wow, the combat's actually good. And it kept getting better. And the one good thing you can really say about Bioshock Infinite is that the combat is great until the end. Where you can't even use that hook shot to, what's it called, you know, fling yourself around. Cause it's useless there. But in the game before that, tell me there's nothing more badass than to hook onto a thing, roll along the wire, you know, you're hanging by the wire, you're going down, then release and kill two people before you even hit the ground. You know, just like your Errol Flynn with a gun.
Yeah.
Anyways, we talked way too much about Bioshock. The one thing is that I keep on hearing news about the other thing I haven't gotten, but I'm pretty sure Scott knows about. People are raving about Civ 6 for iOS. And apparently it's the entire game, just without multiplayer.
And you can play it on your iPad now?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, and like, well, forget Civilization Revolution.
Yeah. It totally takes that out. That is pretty impressive. I was not expecting that. And so it's pretty cool if they've managed to get it on there. I think it'll work fine, but you know, you have your whole tile system, one unit per tile, so it's probably easy to select a unit and get them to go and do what you need. So that's really cool.
I mean, the swiping is okay, but there's also a thing that allows you to do it, what's it called? Like, you know, buttons that allow you to maneuver generally. But yeah, I mean, if there is ever a game that you want to have on your iPad that you can play while on a plane or in a train or just sitting around and you don't have your computer nearby, Civ 6 is the game to get. One thing I have to find out is if they allow you to share saves, which would be really nice, but I'm not counting on that. But at some point I'm going to pick up Civ 6 on the iOS.
I think the saves that are sitting on your, if you have this on PC, your saves there would be under a different program language than what's on the iPad, so I don't think your saves would be able to transfer.
That's okay. But like I said, yeah, Civ 6 on your lap without having any laptop.
Very cool.
Yeah, I mean, that I probably will get at some point. The only downfall is I'm wondering what expansions are with it, you know, so I may just wait until everything is released and then they sell on iOS Civ 6, the complete edition with all the expansions, all the, you know, and all that stuff. And I'm, you know, I'm still looking forward to the DLC that's coming. It's going to be $40, but I think it's going to be worth it.
I thought it was 30.
Oh, 30. Whatever. It's going to be premium expansion cost, you know. I've gotten everything for free on Civ 6 because I shelled out the $100 for the Super Ultra Online because I knew I was going to want all the civilizations and all the expansions. Right. You know, I mean, but not this expansion because it's almost an entire game unto itself. But I knew I was going to want all of it, so it was worth it. Just like spending $100 for Injustice 2 with all the DLC, that was extremely worth it. I'm looking forward to Enchantress sometime this month. And one of the funny things, DJ, is that they really haven't spoken much about what Enchantress can do. There's a lot of speculation, but...
We talked about this before. I'm kind of hoping that she'll be similar to Dr. Fate, because...
That's the interaction I want to hear. Her and Dr. Fate, because they're not exactly friends.
Her and Dr. Fate and Black Adam supply a very interesting niche in Injustice 2. And I want to see, like, Enchantress fill another role.
I just
like
feel
that.
Like, you know, it would be a great alternate skin for the Enchantress? Either Zatanna or Madame Xanadu. Imagine...
Zatanna would be rad.
Zatanna as an alternate skin. Because I know that if she fights Black Canary, they're going to each discuss fishnet stockings. Anyways, so I've been playing Bioshock. And, you know, I will be playing Assassin's Creed Origins, so I'll be giving what I think about that next week.
Cool.
But right now we're going to talk about our news item, and the first news item is going to be something we discussed, like, last year. And I know it's something that Scott's really been irritated about the entire time, even though he didn't back it. Project Phoenix accused of being a scam. This comes for us from GameSpot. In 2013, the Kickstarter campaign for the strategy RPG game Project Phoenix launched, proposing to bring together the talent that had previously worked at Square Enix and Blizzard, including Final Fantasy music composer Nobuo Uematsu, and he also did the music for Blue Dragon, which I loved. The ambitious project built a great deal of anticipation from strategy fans looking for a new game that delivered large-scale combat with a dark and mature storyline. The crowdfunding campaign was a huge success for director and producer Hiroyuki Ura, passing its modest $100,000 goal to reach a final tally of $1 million. Unfortunately, work on Project Phoenix stalled, resulting in fewer updates on the game and lack of communication for its nearly 16,000 backers. Eventually, the director formed a new studio called Area 35, bringing the stalled game with them to his new venture. And by the way, they have had some gameplay screenshots of Project Phoenix, and it looks like a 3DS... console RPG looks that bad in a cutesy way, but that's not what people were expecting. In November 2017, former Area 35 developer Tariq Lacey publicly accused the studio of misappropriating funds from Project Phoenix Kickstarter to work on Tiny Metal, a different strategy game. Area 35 has vehemently denied this accusation, however. During a meeting with GameSpot, Area 35 shared several documents with them, showing contracts made with private investors and the planned budget for Project Phoenix, including all financials with it therein. Unfortunately, the developers are not at liberty to share these documents publicly, but their hope is that showing them with the press would offer some added perspective and transparency on the matter, which, by the way, is a contradiction in terms. You're showing it to the press, but not the people. That's not transparent to the people who back your game, just so you know. Which Yura wishes to provide light of in recent accusations from Lacey. Despite all that has happened with the Kickstarter campaign, Yura and the developers of Area 35 are still passionate about what Project Phoenix can become. And right there, I'm going to underline that, because, hello, wasn't this supposed to be will be, not what can become? I thought, you know, that makes you wonder, what? Wait, can become? I thought you were... Anyways, the director went on to describe his passion for the MMO genre and how that fueled his desire to put together the campaign for Kickstarter. Still, he admits that he was overwhelmed by the rush of attention that came to the game. Wait a minute. if anybody read the Kickstarter profile page, they bragged about their people working on Mass Effect and World of Warcraft and all these other major titles. What did they expect? You're still confident that things would pick up for Project Phoenix after the launch of Tiny Metal. While there's a sizable amount of work to be done on the Kickstarter game, the developers are pleased with how Tiny Metal turned out and plan to continue support on it for some time after its launch. Still, Yuri is aware of the frustrations from his backers on Project Phoenix and hopes they can resume work on it soon. Now, other stuff that I didn't write here because it's a shit ton long article, but he went on to say that profits from Tiny Metal are going to be going towards Project Phoenix, which to me is a big head scratcher. And I feel bad for Tiny Metal because no matter how good the game is, it's going to be tainted by this controversy. And I don't know who's going to want to buy it, no matter how good it is.
I think some people who maybe aren't aware of this whole controversy might get it. But yeah, it is tainted. And it's a real shame because it seems like the money was indeed used for this Tiny Metal game instead of the Project Phoenix.
Now, I'm going to say right now, Tiny Metal looks good. And, a nice little game, a nice little indie game. But that's not what people who backed it on Project Phoenix, that's not what they backed Project Phoenix for.
They're going to feel betrayed because of this.
And it's like, they're going to use the funds from Tiny Metal to pay for Project Phoenix. What about the funds that were given to Project Phoenix to make Project Phoenix?
Exactly. It's just... Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures of this Tiny Metal, and this doesn't look like this was a $1 million game. So I'm wondering, where did that money go?
Now, here's the thing. We discussed this, I think it was even 2 years ago. And one of the reasons why it was delayed is because they had their sights on a programmer, but it had not secured his service yet. And the programmer said, sorry, I'm working on something else. And they were stuck without a programmer. One thing about a video game and a Kickstarter is that you do not start a Kickstarter on a game that hasn't been worked on at all. You know, that's why board game Kickstarters are usually pretty safe, because board game Kickstarters, they've been working on the game for months and months and maybe over a year before they even start the Kickstarter. They already have the planned concept, they have the prototype ready, all they need is the funds to mass produce it. These guys did not have the game prototyped, even. They just had an idea, and they said, you know what, this sounds like a cool idea, and if we can get this guy to work on it, you know, we need the funds to pay this guy to work on it. That's not how you start a Kickstarter, because that's a way to end your Kickstarter before it's even begun. You know, they should have been working on it. Now, Sid Meier, I think it was even 10 years ago, talked about how he makes games. And sometimes he'll start games, but he'll just abandon them if he figures out it's not going to work or it's not fun. That's why everybody was excited about Sid Meier's Dinosaurs. You remember he was going to make a strategy dinosaur game? But he dropped it because it wasn't going to work. You know? That's the problem. You know, video games are started all the time. But what people don't know is a lot of them are dropped without them even knowing that they ever existed. And that's the problem with doing a Kickstarter. And you don't have your game ready. You don't even know if it's going to work yet.
Yeah.
I agree. They seem to have very loose ideas of what the game was even going to have. I mean, they had a few concept arts for a couple of their character arch classes on their website, and there's not much else there.
It's looking like a Super Nintendo game.
Yeah.
Now, that reminds me of another game. Remember the game that was started by Playdick and is being worked on by Little Orbit? And there was a controversy about that one. Because Playdick basically used the funds of, what was the name of the game? Is it Unsung Story? Hold on, let me figure this out. I think it was Unsung Story. Yeah, Unsung Story, Tales of the Guardians. So what happens was, if you remember that story, there's another Japanese company who did the Kickstarter for Unsung Story, and then Playdick just dropped it and worked on another game. And they used the funds that were done by Unsung Story to do their other game. And Little Orbit came in and said, you know, we're gonna pick this up, we're gonna finish this. And actually, fans don't even know if they're ever going to see that. But on the other hand, you know. Anyways, I've trailed off. Feel free to comment, because I'm...
Yeah, I don't really have high hopes for this game, but, you know, Project Phoenix, that was our original story. You know, it's like you said, this has been mishandled and looks like it's been misappropriated and, man, and just, it doesn't look good. You know, they've hurt their image, you know, so,
They've hurt Tiny Metal, for one.
Tiny Metal and any prospect of this game, probably. And it's, you know, it's been like 4 years now. It's going on 5. And
you know, the funny thing is, if they hadn't done a Kickstarter and just started working on Project Phoenix and realized it didn't work, and then they said, oh, wait, this Tiny Metal thing looks good, and they did a Kickstarter for Tiny Metal, then they would have, you know, they would have been heroes. And people will love Tiny Metal. It's like, you know, don't start one game and then do another. That's what they're successful Kickstarters. I'm not going to call them a scam. I'm just going to call them a major oops.
Yeah, the lack of foresight of what they were doing. They seem to have had good intentions of actually making a game. They just didn't have it very planned out very well.
Imagine
and
if,
like you said, they
go ahead.
They should have had something developed, you know, something to show off, you know, like this is our concept, this is our idea, and they just kind of came in with a very big, broad sense of what they were going to do, as opposed to having something more concrete.
You know, I bet if Toyama Naoya Tomita worked on Mighty No. 9 and then showed it off the way it was eventually released, and people wouldn't be bitching about it as much.
Yeah. I don't know.
It was a serviceable game. At least Yooka-Laylee was exactly what they promised. Unfortunately, what they promised was with the problem is that people had a nostalgia filter of what Banjo-Kazooie was really like. It's exactly like Banjo-Kazooie. All the good and the bad.
Absolutely.
And I know you're down on it simply because you had to do a strategy guide for it.
Oh, yeah. I know that game front to back. And you know what? That was... I'm not going to say it was a waste of my time because I got paid for it. But
you got achievements, right?
That was a lot of effort and a lot of... I don't know. Opportunity cost, we'll say, that I will never get back.
Yeah. Anyways.
But, as for this thing, like, I feel like we're preaching to the choir at this point, but at the same time, it's like, they didn't have a programmer for the part of the game that they were for the time in which they were supposed to make the game.
No, they just had an idea for the game, and they had the intentions of hiring this one programmer. And when that programmer said, "Sorry, I'm working on something else. You can find someone else," they were like, "What? Wait, they didn't have a backup."
That's when you get your butt in gear and look for a backup.
Well, they did. They couldn't find one that was going to help them. I mean, that was on the level that they needed. So they just hemmed and hawed. I remember they had this guy who they hired as their composer. I think I'm thinking of a different game, but there was a game which it wasn't this game, but there was a game which had a similar problem. They hired a composer, and the composer was like 21, and he left when he was 23 after working on it for 2 years, and it still wasn't finished. Anyway, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Platinum Games working on 2 self-published games. This is from PC Gamer. Bayonetta and Vanquish developer Platinum Games is working on 2 self-published games, its first stab at going it alone. Head of development Atsushi Inaba told Game Informer that in 2017, the company encouraged game pitches from all its staff, which has yielded 2 designs that were generally focused on. Inaba said he wants the new games to surprise the fan base, but not because of their genre. If you're going to put 20 people on the development, it has to be something that's on brand and on topic. And obviously, when people think of Platinum Games brand, they expect crazy hardcore action, right? That's what they're looking for, and so we have to be
reticent.
That doesn't sound like the right word to use.
Well, maybe it's translation, not sure. So Platinum Games, okay. They also did Devil May Cry, and I love Bayonetta. Unfortunately,
DMC. Platinum Games didn't do Devil May Cry.
Oh, yeah. Well, the guys same guys.
They did. Capcom.
Because they keep on making references, and they keep on talking about maybe doing a Bayonetta Devil May Cry crossover at some point. And Dante is basically Bayonetta as a dude.
Well, Dante came first.
I know, but Bayonetta's better.
Nah, I don't know about that.
But yeah, so they're going to go it alone without using Sega, which should be interesting. And if they're doing indie games, they're probably going to be at least, you know, smaller in development scope. You know, it's not going to be the level of graphics that you see in games like Vanquish and Bayonetta. And I'm worried about, you know what? Here's the thing. They could use the Kickstarter route, because you know that they're going to first develop like half the game and then use Kickstarter sort of like a pre-order.
I wonder if they're going to try to bring Scalebound back to life.
That's true, but it's not going to be as big a scope as the original Scalebound was going to be, which is going to be sort of like Monster Hunter D with dragons.
Yeah. So, for those of you who don't know, Scalebound was one of the games that was... Was that at E3 this year or last year?
That was at E3, the first time they showed off the Xbox One X.
Right. So, it was going to be sort of a...
This was when they first showed off the Xbox One.
Yeah. So, it was going to be a Devil May Cry style game with also shooting elements and sort of a mix between Devil May Cry, Monster Hunter, Dragon, Panzer Dragon.
More like what Final Fantasy 15 turned out to be.
Yeah. And it fell through. It just fell flat on its face and never made it out of the hangar. So,
which is a shame because a lot of people have good memories of Panzer Dragoon and they thought, oh, finally another Panzer Dragoon type of game, even though it wasn't going to be that. It was going to be something with dragons.
There's going to be all sorts of things.
What?
There's going to be all sorts of things. I saw Devil May Cry. Some people saw Panzer Dragoon. Other people saw Monster Hunter. It had a lot of things going on.
Dragon. Or actually, even more on point, Dragonheart. Because the dragons talk back to you. And they were not pets. They were more like companions who followed you around with their own personality. Dang.
Sean Connery is way too old to voice a dragon anymore. He was the voice of Drago in Dragonheart. Did you not know that?
Yeah, he's not going to play. This wasn't going to be Dragonheart. It was going to be its own.
He's retired anyways. But you're never too old to play a dragon. That's silly, TJ. You know dragons can be thousands of years old.
Sean Connery is thousands of years old at this point.
Exactly. He's perfect.
So, I'm looking forward to this. I'd be interested to see what they're going to do. You know, I wonder what would happen if Suda51 and Platinum got together and did a game. Oh, wait, did they already do that? I don't think so.
No, I don't think that they've done that just yet.
Could you imagine that?
I feel like a couple major dudes like Yoko Taro and I think maybe Suda51 had an interview with one another at some point, and it was pretty
fun. There was a lot of speculation of people doing it. There's people who want to see that. Suda51 Platinum Games, what's it called? Collaboration.
Hideki Kamiya is also awesome. I love reading his Twitter.
Yeah.
It's basically just miles and miles of being pretty happy about the way that people have responded to his games, and then also smashing people who come to him with dumb questions.
Oh, jeez, I forgot his name now. Hold on. I'm trying to remember his friggin' name. Oh, yeah. He's sort of the anti-Hideo Kojima, who's just basically a just a conspiracy nut. Earth, that's what he comes off as when you play Metal Gear games.
Hmm.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next time. Take it away, TJ.
Mutant Football League kicks off the new year with a console launch from Polygon. 25 years later, Mutant Football is coming back to consoles. Mutant Football League, by the Chicago-based indie studio Digital Dreams, and the creator of the 1993 Sega Genesis classic Mutant Football League, will launch January 19th. Mutant League
Football, come on, you got it backwards.
Sorry. Mutant League Football will launch January 19th on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. The game launched on Windows PC last Halloween, but the console release fulfills Michael Mendheim's promise to restore the zany, blood and guts, body parts fly around brand of football he pioneered a quarter century ago to the living room couch where it always belonged. Nighthawk Interactive is Mutant Football League's console publisher, and a retail edition of the game will come in the summer. Mendheim has more plans for free content coming after January 19th as well. Sometime in February or March, Digital Dreams will publish a free update to Mutant Football League, adding a multi-season dynasty mode to the game in which a player takes control of one of the 18 teams, but at the lowest possible rating, and builds them into a powerhouse over several seasons. That update will also pack in a customizable playbook and a feature where defeating a CPU team in the season gives the user its dirty tricks, somewhat like a boss battle reward. It's worth pointing this out because Mutant Football League went out as a Kickstarter project in 2013 and landed with a thud, coming nowhere close to its fundraising target. Mendheim paid attention to what fans wanted and expected, however,
and
worked the next 3 years on building that game, that kind of game, with a shoestring budget. Digital Dreams went back to Kickstarter for a shot of cash in early 2017 and more than doubled its goal. This is rad because I was watching all the Saturday morning cartoons in the late 1980s and 1990s, and Mutant League was my shit.
I actually preferred Blood Bowl, but the problem with the Blood Bowl said I like the original SSI game that was on the Commodore 64. I'm not as big a fan as the games that were recently released in the past few years. And this one, you know, when my ears perked up at the idea of having a multi-season dynasty mode.
Mm-hmm.
About the game is that even if you're losing, you can still win if you've managed to kill as many people on the other team so that they don't have a full team they can put out on the thing and they're forced to resign.
This could be your redemption and slightly bittersweet on top of your Madden experience this last year.
I guess. this is an arcade football game. It isn't pretending to be a sim. You know, I mean, how many other games where you can have your team kill the referee?
You can have the New York Giants and they would actually be Giants.
Right. Why am I thinking about the Skaven now from... Because the New York Rats. Scott, have you played Mutant League Football at all?
No, I've never heard of this.
Really?
Never heard of it. No.
Well, you should go to it's exactly what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. You have a team of monsters that play football. They have a team of monsters that play football, and there are no rules. And you can cripple and kill the other players and force them to fumble that way. You know. You know, there's a game, I remember Cybertron? No. There was a game for the Amiga in which you had robots playing football. And you could upgrade the robots. It was also an arcade game, too. I think it was Cybertron.
There were quite a few baseball games like that, too. Base Wars was a good one.
I remember Speedball was basically a futuristic football game.
I can't remember what came first, if it was the game or the cartoon. But,
that was the name of the game.
Mutant League cartoon was...
It came after, but not long after. I think Sega was really banking on the game to be a big hit, and it was.
Yeah.
The cartoon was really weird, but, you know, how many cartoons can you make about monsters playing football?
It was like terrifying when I was little because like in the intro. Yeah, it was in the intro. The people are playing football and then the ground opens up. This one dude's skin just falls off his body and all sorts of monsters just start coming out.
The '90s, everybody, the '90s. Do you remember the grotesque balls? What's it called? That got their own cartoon as well. Mad Balls.
Yeah.
Also, of course, wait, no, but you see, Garbage Pail Kids were actually in the '80s.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still a '90s sort of thing. I really wish they would remake Cyberball. I miss that game so much.
I'm excited to see this coming back, though. I will totally play this.
So, Scott, by the way, I'm pretty sure this would be your type of game, even if you're not into football. It's just fun action and humorous violence.
I'll look into it. I have heard of Blood Bowl, so it's...
Yeah, but Blood Bowl is based on the board game, and mm-hmm. it's a little more intellectual. This one, you know, as intellectual as you can do with having two teams of creatures fighting it out as a football game, in a football game, this one is a little bit more over the top and comedic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the other thing is that one thing that the article mentioned that I didn't put down here is that they hired the voice actor who did the Boom Shakalaka from NBA Jam to do the voice work for this. So you can have that extra awesomeness too.
This was basically NBA Jam years before NBA, not NBA Jam. This was NFL Blitz years before NFL Blitz was a thing.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me is that there's whispers that they're actually going to have the XFL coming back again. And this would basically be, you know, XFL except with monsters. So anyways, we did get a lot of we got two listener feedback.
Excellent.
The first one is very short, so I'll just read it. It is from Jeffy, and last week, 2 weeks ago, the last episode we had, we were talking about what games we wanted to see in 2018. Jeffy says, Red Dead Redemption 2, baby, can't wait for it. So, yeah.
God, did we completely miss talking about that last time.
It was an entire hour of us talking about it. It went on so long that you and Scott were almost asleep at the end.
I don't remember us ever mentioning Red Dead Redemption 2 in that whole thing.
That was the first thing I mentioned.
Oh. It was a long episode, everybody.
For
those who listened to the entire episode, I did the thing in which we'd said our goodbyes and then, you know, silence. Actually, I did Jingle Bells instrumental, and after that, I revealed the rest of the podcast in which you both were just like, oh God, we gotta go to sleep, this is taking too long, and all that stuff.
We recorded for 3 hours.
I know. And it was midnight for you, 9 PM for me.
God bless anyone who will listen to that whole thing.
DJ, take the next listener feedback.
This one's from Ralph. Hi guys. Thanks for this big long episode. I really enjoyed it. I like long ones. You get more from the same source. I hope you all
have... actually.
Of course you'd think that. But I hope all of you had a nice Christmas and a good start in the new year.
It's just begun. So.
The games I am waiting for in 2018 are Last of Us 2, Bloodstained, Magic the Gathering Arena, Ni No Kuni 2.
By the way, we didn't mention Ni No Kuni 2 last week. That's one that we forgot to talk about.
Yeah. That one's going to be interesting. I really like the first one.
Didn't we play it? We played it at E3 too.
Yeah, it was. There was a demo at E3, and it was really neat. Have you played the first one, Scott? The White Witch.
I have. It plays a lot like Pokemon. I mean, it's so Pokemon. I'm surprised it didn't get sued by whoever owns Pokemon.
Now I'm interested.
Nice. Death Stranding. Yes.
Well, I think we're all. That's going to be. That's gonna be. We just mentioned his damn name again. His next.
I think
game
we're
after
Hideo Kojima.
Yeah, after leaving Konami, that's gonna be his first game.
I think we're all in for Impreg Norman Reedus. But Seasons of Heaven, Mega Man 11, and Soul Calibur 6. Magic the Gathering Arena is only a card game and is nearly the same game as already available as Magic the Gathering Online. But it has a different look, more like Hearthstone, and I am totally into the card games. I am too, and I'm actually, like, shocked that I know that Magic the Gathering Online was a thing, but I'm shocked to know, to see that, like, yeah, but they haven't leaned into it the way that, maybe they just don't have the,
yearly update, the PR. That's all.
Maybe they don't have the PR that Blizzard has behind them, but it shocks me to see that Magic the Gathering
in a virtual form.
Magic
the Gathering has friggin' Wizards of the Coast behind them.
Yeah, so why don't they lean into that and totally give Hearthstone a run for money?
I think they've been leaning harder into D&D. That's my thing. By the way, Magic the Gathering Online, Magic the Gathering Arena does have a closed beta right now. You can go to their site and sign up for it.
Mm-hmm. That's rad. That is really cool to see that they're actually leading into more of an online virtual Magic the Gathering thing. It needs it. I mean, for as many players as there are out there, that community totally deserves
it. I'm weird. I'd like to see another Magic the Gathering Duel of the Planeswalkers, a single-player RPG that's based on Magic dueling.
I would totally
I loved that game
too.
When it was out in the mid-90s. That was an addiction for me.
But as hot as Hearthstone and like they did the Witcher one, Gwent, as hot as those games have been, there is absolutely no reason for Magic the Gathering to not have like a full on online virtual game where they're leaning hard into that and getting it out there.
That reminds me, it reminds me of the mid 80s when there were a bunch of computer role playing games out there. And it's sort of like people were saying, well, when is Dungeons and Dragons going to be a computer role playing game? And then the Gold Box games came out. It's like, yeah, we're the monsters in the room, and here we come, get out of our way, you know? And you could actually have that with Magic the Gathering in this sort of format. They should be, we're Magic the Gathering, get out of our way.
Absolutely.
There's no Pokemon, there's no Yu-Gi-Oh, there's nothing without us starting it.
That's totally what I'm saying, because they've been around the block forever.
Even Pillars of Eternity has done a card game now. I think it's Lords of something, I forgot what it was called. It just seems like there's a lot of card games out there. Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, why isn't Magic Gathering pushing more into it? I don't know. I mean, I've actually gotten into this other card game, because usually I'm not really into card games, but this one called Mage War is kind of interesting, and it gives you like an arena thing, and you have an actual wizard on the board that you're using.
Yeah, I
demoed
that game. It was pretty fun.
It's a lot of fun. I think I wish Magic was more like that, where your wizard was actually in the action and not just kind of abstract.
But here's the thing. That reminds me. You know what? Speaking of another property, why is it, you have Dungeons & Dragons Online, which I think is still a free online MMO, but it's sort of like an afterthought. Why isn't they mishandled that? Because Dungeons & Dragons should be where World of Warcraft is right now.
Yeah, they should have an entire Faerun world to go explore. That people have been asking for that for years.
Here's the thing. Everybody, you have Baldur's Gate, you have the Forbidden City, the Forgotten City. You have Hillsfar, you have all these major sites, and you could just go nuts with a D&D MMO and include the Plains. And have people having to go into the Plains. And by the way, that would be a great place to have raids. D&D has so much material and they've done nothing with it.
I mean, outside of awesome board games.
Lords of Waterdeep is the best. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I guess they just have a different focus and they're not really interested in.
I don't, Wizards of the Coast, be more like TSR.
Yeah, well, that's.
I mean, that's if the I problem. Were running it, I would start devoting the gobs and gobs of money they must be making for Magic Gathering. It's probably not as much as it was in the late 90s, when everybody and their mother, you couldn't swing a dead cat without people playing Magic Gathering.
I think the gaming world would be very different if TSR was still around doing the D&D instead of Magic the Gathering. I can't even imagine what it would be like. It would be different.
Here's the problem is that TSR was crap with money, which is why they were bankrupt twice and why Wizards of the Coast was able to buy them, because they had the license and they did nothing with it. They even had a cartoon show, which I really enjoyed, a Saturday morning cartoon show based on Dungeons.
I remember. I watched it too.
So yeah, Ralph, we're totally in for Magic the Gathering Arena. Most of the titles, last part of his message here, most of the titles are also not new, but I really hope that these new parts of the series are as good as the ones before. I really like your podcast and hope you will do this for a long time in the future. Greetings from Germany, Ralph.
By the way,
thank you.
This is episode 488, so we're coming up on 500.
Woohoo!
I did ask Paul if he wanted to do today's episode, and he wasn't able to, so... You know, because it's January 1st. I wanted to do a January 1st episode.
Who needs Paul and his weird Disney Infinity lust?
I will forward that on to him. Maybe that influence him to come next week. But yeah, we don't have a question of the week. Just let us know what you think. And you know what? We're just going to continue it. Are there any games in 2018 that you're really looking forward to? And apparently, TJ there forgot that Red Dead Redemption existed.
Yeah, I mean, we've had like, what, 2 1-minute long trailers? It's kind of easy to forget.
Yeah, but he's blinded by Dragon Ball Fighter Z. I think that's basically the 10-ton elephant in the way of everything else that he can't see beyond. Because he sees Dragon Ball, he sees Arc Systems, and that's all he can see right now.
On my New Year's, I spent some time playing Blaze Blue and beating people because I don't respect them or their children.
Yeah, you know, Blaze Blue is one of those fighting games that has a very... Not many people talk about, but it's there, and it's like it has the most... the vocal fans in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That'll defend that game till the sun dies.
Yes. I've had people yell at me. I've had people yell at me that I'm not doing it right.
But you know the funny thing? Actually, now that I think about it, you know what? They started the entire idea of having two characters when they face off having specific dialogue tailored to them, or at least make it sound, you know, that way, that NetherRealms did with Mortal Kombat 9 and 10 and with Injustice.
Yeah, it was around a little bit with Street Fighter where, like, you'd have Ken and Ryu, like, bump fists before they would start a fight. But Blaze Blue and Guilty Gear leaned into it, like, 10 times as hard as anyone else did around the time.
You know, credit NetherRealm. They saw a good idea and just did it themselves with recognizable characters.
Yeah, and it's to the point where in Blaze Blue Central Fiction, they're, like, there are a ton of... Like, there are a lot of generic interactions, but there are also a ton of unique ones between the characters.
Yeah. And I'm glad that exists in Injustice 2, because otherwise, the main story is shit, but there's so much more better story just from the interactions during, like, when Black Lightning speaks to Raiden and talks about how he wants to learn from Raiden because he sees him as someone who could teach him stuff, or when he and Vixen talk together about restarting the Justice League. Or whenever the Atom talks to Hellboy or whatever, and everybody's looking forward to the Hellboy Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles interaction, that should be very interesting.
Yeah, totally.
By the way, one of my favorite exchanges of the new ones is when Black Canary does her thing about having good looks, a fashionable dresses, and a killer right hook. Hellboy says, "Wait till you see mine." Because for those of you who don't know, Hellboy has the right fist, the right hand of doom.
He basically has a pillar for a second up for one of his arms.
Yeah.
Anyways, we will see you next week, and hopefully we'll have convinced Paul to join us.
Yeah,
calling you up, Paul.
Come on, Paul. Let's have fun.
Anyways, we will see you next week.
Have a happy gaming, everyone.
Play games, have fun, be cool, y'all.
And let's hope 2018 is better.